honour to interview Ian Watson. I've been wanting to get him on my podcast for quite some time, following especially when I went to one of his seminars, where he talked about the concept of insight and why it is some people seem to get well and others don't. It was brilliant to have him on. Ian has worked in the wellbeing and personal transformation space for over 30 years and has written numerous highly regarded homeopathy books. We chat through in more detail this concept of insight and why it's the most potent factor in healing. Ian explains why healing doesn't have to be complicated or time consuming. I ask him whether everyone can heal, and I also ask him to explain what is susceptibility. Ian shares his view on homeopathic miasms. That's something you might have heard, the term miasms, and not be quite sure what it is. Well, now you're going to be enlightened. And Ian talks through the collective realization on internal versus external authority, particularly in regards to the events of the last 2 years. I ask Ian what his favorite homeopathic remedy is. And Ian explains why first aid homeopathic prescribing can have such a huge impact. And finally, I ask Ian whether homeopathy will always continue to survive despite attempts to discredit it.
There is so much that I wanted to chat to you about. And like, this is like so exciting for me because obviously I've got all your books. And
where's the red one? I don't see the red one.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I haven't got all your books. So these are like my favourites. And yeah, I just think I've got so many questions on a personal, selfish level.
Yeah, go for it. You can ask me anything.
Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant. So yeah, I guess for people that are listening, Ian, you're an amazing. You don't practice homeopathy anymore, do you? Can you introduce yourself briefly in your own words?
Yeah, I haven't practiced professionally for quite a long number of years, many years, but I still work, as an educator and trainer. Mm. And I use homeopathy. It's my medicine of choice with myself, my family, my kids, my friends. So it's not that I've, got rid of homeopathy from my life. On the contrary, it's still my first port of call. It's just that my own professional life took me in a different direction.
Yeah. And what are you doing? Well, I went to one of your seminars back in Christmas. We were just talking before I hit record. But yeah, what are you doing now?
Well, some of it is like that. I get invites to go and work still with, homeopathic groups. And more so recently, actually, it seems to be the ripple seems to be spreading out. But most of my work is training people in the three principles of understanding so that they can either bring that into their existing work or they can have it be the foundation of their work, as it is for me. That's become the kind of, the heart of everything that I do since 2011.
And I went to one of your, the seminar I went to, you were explaining insight and this concept of insight. And I'm not going to do it anywhere near justice trying to explain it, but can you briefly explain it to people that are listening and thinking, what's she going on about with insight? And yeah, what does it mean?
Yeah. Do you want me to do that now?
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah. It's a funny thing because when I first came into the three principles of understanding, that was the first insight that I had, was about insight, which sounds a bit mad. But what I'd grappled with for a long time was several sort of phenomena that I observed. When you work with a lot of people over a lot of years, you start to notice themes and patterns. So one of the things I noticed was that some people just stay stuck no matter what you do. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in any kind of derogatory way. That's been me at times in my life, there's a way in which we can just get stuck, and there's also a way in which we can just replace one issue with another forever, which is another form. It's another form of stuckness. We're not just necessarily stuck with the one thing, but we're in a cycle of constantly working on ourselves and trying to fix ourselves. And I saw a lot of that in my work, and I could see myself getting caught in that from time to time. And then I'd see other people. Sometimes I'd work with clients. This was when I was way back, as a homeopath. People would come in, we'd have a bit of a chat, they'd get relaxed, and something would shift for them. And it was visible. I could see it. They could feel it. And they'd say, oh, I know what I'm going to do. And they were good to go. And I was like, well, I haven't even started yet. And they were giving me the credit for the fact that they felt better. They could see new possibilities, that whatever problem they seemed up against was no longer a problem. And I was like, how did that happen? And what I came to see, that's insight. Insight is when a person spontaneously has a shift in their level of consciousness, in their level of understanding, and it happens from within. So it's not to do with information. And what I've come to realize, it's a different kind of learning. It's a different way that we evolve, that we grow and learn. So there's nothing wrong with the informational way of learning. It's helpful for some things, but it's not that good if you're trying to break a pattern or move to a new level of well-being, or let's say let go of a habit, you know, a destructive habit or something like that. You see, if information worked, nobody would smoke anymore.
Yeah, totally.
Right? And in fact, there's all kinds of things that we wouldn't do anymore. If data alone was enough to change people's behavior, we've got loads of data telling us what's harmful and carcinogenic, and we just keep doing these things. Well, why? Mm-hmm. Because the person hasn't actually had a realization. When someone has an insight or realization, you don't have to tell them what to do anymore. You don't have to give them advice, because suddenly something stops making sense to them that used to make sense, and now something else makes more sense, so they do that. Mm. And it's a seamless and an effortless way of changing, and it's sustainable. When people change on that level, they can never go back to where they were before they had the insight. So it's, to me, it was a game changer as far as personal transformation is concerned, which is what I've always been interested in. And once I started to understand that through my own insight, funnily enough, then that became my work, was like, okay, it's not about teaching people information and telling them what they should do rather than do this, do that. It's more about creating a space within which they can have their own insight. Mm. That is the basis of my work. And what kind of insight they have, I don't know. What's that? They don't know. But it turns out that people get the insight they need at the time. There's actually a wisdom behind it. There's an intelligence behind it. So it's always the right thing for the individual, and which is very cool, but it's also somewhat frustrating for people because they see something which transforms their life. Of course, they want to tell it to the world. Mm. You see this in your work all the time. And so then they write a book about it and they get very, you know, excited. It's like, I found the thing that changed my life. And everybody else just reads the book and their life doesn't change.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
That's why the bookshops have got walls full of self-help titles, and people don't just buy one. They buy one after the other, looking for the one that's going to change their life. None of them are going to change your life. It's your own insight that will change your life. Nothing else will do it.
And I guess that it has to resonate with you, doesn't it, on that, about resonance as well. What is going to create insight for you?
And exactly. What for someone and that's else? That's a key part to understanding it is, there has to be a receptivity. If there's something coming from the outside, whether it's through a book or what somebody says, insight doesn't need an outside reference. It can just come purely from within. But often it's catalyzed by something external. You know, you hear something or you read something and it kind of wakens something up that was in you already. But you're right, there has to be that resonance, that susceptibility, we would call it in homeopathic terms. And if there isn't, they just go straight past you.
I do know, that's a good segue, actually, that where you said about susceptibility. I loved the way you explained susceptibility on another podcast that that you were on recently, which I will put the link into. But for people that are obviously listening to this, can you explain, because this concept of susceptibility we talk about a lot in homeopathy. Can you explain what susceptibility is?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful and it's crucial to understand in order to make sense of things like homeopathy. And other forms of energy medicine. And that's why I spent a lot of time kind of pondering it and investigating it and trying to get under the skin of it, because it felt important to me, and I eventually came to see why. And I think part of it connects to the fact that homeopathy is an energy medicine doesn't make sense to people who can only think in material terms. Mm. You know, it's like, how can you dilute to the point where there's no molecules left and still have it do something? Well, one of the ways that we can come to understand that is through understanding susceptibility. But it's important also because it explains why it is that when there's, for example, an outbreak, an epidemic of the flu or something like that, well, why does some people get sick and but not everybody does? Even in the same family, some people are completely unaffected. And the alleged virus or bacteria or whatever we say is causing it, well, it should be, you know, it's there. If it's there, it should be available for everyone. If that's the causative agent, everybody should be equally liable to get sick, and they don't. So it has to be something internal. And when there's an internal susceptibility, it seems that we need very little in terms of external stimulus in order to catalyze a quite powerful reaction, whether that's what we would call a pathogenic reaction. And an example of that would be an allergy. You know, someone who's got hay fever susceptibility, they just get a whiff of pollen from 100 yards and they're sneezing and their eyes are watering. But the friend who they're walking with is like, why are you crying? You know, nothing happening for them. That has to be a susceptibility issue. We can't blame it on the pollen, because if it was the pollen on its own, everybody should get the same symptoms. So it explains how we are interacting with the environment in a way which, again, it's very selective. Most things don't bother us, but there are some things that really bother us to a high level. And what I started to realize was that, that's how homeopaths can get away with using remedies which have got virtually nothing in them, is that we're actually using susceptibility in a positive way. And how do we do that? We do that by taking a case and finding a remedy that matches the symptoms. And it has to be a pretty good match. And if it's not, we score a miss. You know, it's the same as somebody walking past a field of pollen who's not susceptible to hay fever. It just doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
Right? Or somebody eating peanuts who doesn't have a peanut allergy. It's like, what's your problem? You know, no problem. And yet to the one who's susceptible, it's a big deal. Well, it's like that with homeopathic remedies, I believe. If the remedy is well chosen, then there's a good match. There's what we call symptom similarity between the symptom picture that a person's presenting and the picture that we know is associated with that particular substance. If that is close enough, one to the other, the person will be highly sensitive to that particular remedy at this moment in time. And not just to remedies generally, which is why kids can eat half the remedies from your kit and nothing happens, right? I've had this happen many times. You've probably had people tell you the same stories. Like, oh my God, you know, my son's just eaten half the contents of my first aid kit. I say, well, how is your son? Oh, seems to be fine. they don't do anything. They're not remedies for a person who doesn't need them.
Yeah. Right. I love that. I love the way you explain that. It makes so much sense. Yeah, we're using it sort of in a different way to look at it from the homeopathic perspective. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. And it's, you know, that to me was an insight about how homeopathy works. It's like, oh, yeah, it must be that. What else could it be? how else could we explain that we can give a remedy that someone doesn't need? We can give them it, you know, loads of doses, different potencies. Nothing happens. If they don't need it, nothing happens, essentially. The only exception to that is when we're doing provings.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about provings, because I have proved, many homeopaths say, I never see provings happen in practice. And I've early on proved Nox Vomica 200 when my homeopath gave it to me just on three occasions. And he didn't tell me what he was giving me. And it was so, you know, and then I went back and I was like, awful, everything's annoying me. Like the noise of everything is irritating me. I'm so irritable and angry and I'm turned constipated, you know. And I said, what did you give me? And he was like, Nox Vomica. And I was like, what do you think about provings? Like, do you think it can happen frequently or?
Not in that kind of scenario. That's not that common. I mean, what you're describing is, I would just call it an intensification of symptoms. You know, it's like an aggravation plus a bit more. I mean, I'm guessing is that remedy was probably helpful for you.
No, and any of the symptoms. It wasn't return of old symptoms or anything.
So it wasn't curative in any sense?
No.
Okay. No. Okay. Because there's always different possibilities.
Completely.
And for some people, you just get the what we call the aggravation, where there's an intensification of existing symptoms, and sometimes you get one or two extra symptoms that belong to the remedy, but you're getting better, so you don't really worry about it. You just stop taking it and it all goes away. But when the remedy seems to bring out symptoms that you didn't have before, we call that proving. Sorry, that's just my calendar telling me we have a call. The thing with the proving is that they're usually done intentionally, which means that you have an individual or usually a group of individuals who agree that they're going to do a proving as a test. It's like our form of a clinical trial, I suppose, to discover what that remedy is capable of producing. And the fact that you introduce in the intention to prove changes everything. Because what that enables, it's very fascinating how this works, because most people, almost everyone who just takes, let's say, one dose of a remedy they don't need, nothing will happen. It's a very rare individual that something will happen. And they have to be usually highly sensitive. And that remedy has got to have, they've got to have some degree of susceptibility to that particular remedy for something to happen. Whereas with approving, you can actually have a whole group of people who just take one dose and all kinds of stuff happens. Well, what's the difference? It's the intention.
Yeah.
So there's something about when we focus our intention on doing approving, it increases the susceptibility of the whole group, of the proving group, in a kind of, I don't know, generic, non-specific way. They become susceptible to whatever they take. Now, there's still variations within that, obviously. Some provers, you know, develop hundreds and hundreds of symptoms. Some, that it's a narrow band. So it still varies, but that seems to be a factor in provings, which, again, we can't really explain that in mechanical, materialistic terms. But we can understand it in energetic terms if we recognize that thought is also energy, intention is also energy. Why wouldn't it have an effect?
Yeah, no, that makes sense, the intention point. Have you proved many remedies at all?
No, not deliberately. I haven't. I've participated in a couple of provings only, but I've never, you know, it's not something that I've really gotten into in a big way.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I do find, but that makes perfect sense, that it's the intention, I guess. And we did some meditative provings when I was at college.
Yeah.
And you definitely felt the energy of, so this is for people listening, you don't actually even take the remedy, you're kind of just focusing on the remedy itself. And yeah, it was really interesting, the energy that came up in the room. It definitely shifted with different remedies.
That's it. Yeah, you don't even have to take it. And I think it helps us to remember, I think, that we are energy beings. This looks solid, doesn't it? But it's not.
Yeah.
We're energetic beings. And I think that becomes more visible when you look at things like provings and meditative provings. It's like, well, how's that even possible? Well, we all know that you can go into a room with a group of people and you can feel the energy in the room. I think everybody's sensitive to that to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And then within that, there'll be certain people that you feel drawn towards, who you feel comfortable with. There might be one or two people who you find yourself going like, giving a wide berth. You don't know why. You know, you haven't had a chance to interact with them. You maybe don't know anything about them as a person. That's energy. It's an energetic field effect. You know, we've got energetic tentacles going out in every direction, and we're also picking up. We're both transmitting and receiving. So I think once we start to think about it in those terms, lots of things then make sense that otherwise seem a bit mysterious.
Yeah, if only we could see energy, people's perspective of life would be totally, radically different, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, some people can, obviously. I'm not one of them. I don't hardly ever see energy, but I feel it. I'm more sensitive in terms of how I feel. I learned to pay attention to that early on, and it's become more refined as the years have gone on. But some people see energies directly. I never have.
And that feeling energy, I definitely do as well. But it's something that I guess we're told, or like as a child, you're not taught really to, almost to shut it off, you know, not to be more logically minded rather than.
And that's just a cultural thing, isn't it? And it belongs to the age that we live in and the culture that we live in. If we'd grown up in a different age and a different culture, we would be encouraged to pay attention to these things and to keep that, you know, those senses wide open, which are very open when we're youngsters. So there are some, you know, cultures where that's still the case, where people are encouraged to pay attention to the things that we're being asked to ignore and look away from, or which are just dismissed as, oh, that's your imagination, you know?
Yeah.
Rather than actually crediting the fact that we have more than just the five senses.
Totally. I love this, the concept of susceptibility. So to take it a bit further, people might be thinking, but where does susceptibility come from in the first place?
Yeah, that's a tricky one.
I don't expect you to have all the answers. But
no,
yeah,
I don't really. I mean, to me, it's a good question, but I don't really have a clear answer to that. It seems to be part of what's built in to the energy field, if you like, or to the energy system, mm-hmm. both on an individual level, but also on a collective level. So there are group susceptibilities as well. There are, like, you know, just as we have group dynamics. And here's a speculative answer. Mm. So it looks to me that susceptibility is built into us so that we grow and evolve. Mm. Now, why would I say that? Well, if you think about how evolution happens on a purely biological level, and we've been studying that, you know, in some depth for a good few hundred years now. If you think about it just in those terms, what do we know about evolution? It's basically, it's a challenge and response mechanism. So you have a creature that's living in a certain environment, something in that environment changes, like the temperature changes or the water dries up or the food supply, you know, becomes diminished or something like that, or a new predator appears on the scene, or there's a change. And then in order to survive, to thrive and survive, that particular species has to develop certain characteristics. Certain things have to become strengthened and other things maybe can be jettisoned because they're no longer needed. Mm. And if there isn't that, what you might call a creative, appropriate adaptation, mm. then you don't survive. And nature seems to favor the capacity to adapt and mm. to change. So new attributes come into play and then they become part of the collective field for that particular species. And then the offspring are born with that thing built in. It's like it gets learned and it gets carried forward. So it's not that everybody has to make the same adaptation over and over again. At a certain point, it just gets built in. Now, if you think about it in human terms, well, how do we grow and evolve? Not just biologically. I mean, we're doing that too. You know, there's a reason why we've got thumb and digits and all of this is part of that process. But I think we're also growing and evolving psychologically and spiritually. Well, how does that come about? Well, it's the same mechanism, but happening on a different level. Challenge, we get challenged and we got to respond. And by respond, I mean, we have to access and bring forth potentialities that are within us, but which are not yet developed because we haven't had to use them before. Yeah. So how does that happen? Well, we get challenged in life and it varies from one individual to another. We suffer a loss or a shock or, you know, something in our life gets suddenly upended and we have to adapt. We have to adapt to that change. And sometimes it becomes a circumstance which we're up against for a period of time. Maybe it's a health challenge. You know, it can be all kinds of things. There's lots of different forms it can take. But according to our susceptibility, it seems to me, we get the exact challenge that we need at that moment in our evolution. So it's not random. I mean, it can feel random. It usually does at the time. It's just like, why did this happen to me?
Yeah.
It just feels like bad luck. But from another perspective, you start to see, no, it wasn't bad luck at all. It was exactly what I needed to give me the exact kick in the pants that I needed to move into this next stage of my life. And we can only usually see that with hindsight. From the rear view perspective, we can see, oh, actually, that which I thought was a disaster, I can see now, if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't have done this and I wouldn't have given that up and I wouldn't. And now I'm on a whole different life path. Now I'm grateful that that happened. I wasn't grateful at the time. And it's often like that. We can see afterwards that it was purposeful. So to me, susceptibility is part of that process of us being nudged along our own path of growth. And so we develop susceptibilities, which is like our individual combination of challenges that are the exact ones that we need. That's my theory about it. I can't prove that to anybody, but that's how I choose to think about it.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. Like on a personal level, completely, like things that have been very uncomfortable or painful have shifted, you know, me into other directions. And I've often asked actually on my other podcasts, you know, do we have to reach a precipice? Do most people have to reach a precipice to actually change? Like, And it ties in with what you've said. We can't seem to, that insight, just information alone.
Right.
It's very rare for anyone to change, right? Unless they reach a precipice or insight or, yeah, however we want to term that.
Yeah, I mean, we're making little changes, incremental changes, but oftentimes when there's a big change needed, the nature of a big change is it's a kind of death rebirth cycle. Mm. There has to be some big letting go of maybe a role or an identification that has been very central to who we thought we were up until that point in our life. That has to get stripped away in order that we can then be reborn in a new form. I mean, effectively is what's happening. Almost none of us will take that path voluntarily.
Mm. Yeah.
Not because we don't need to, but because it frightens us. We get familiar with what, you know, what we know is familiar to us and seems to be kind of working, even if it's becoming hard work. You know, sometimes we kind of, we know that we're struggling and we know that there's some changes needed, but we're reluctant to give up the familiar in favor of the unknown, because the unknown is the unknown, right? It's like, what if it's worse? I mean, it turns out it never is, actually. We just imagine it. We imagine that it's going to be worse, but it's not actually.
Yeah. So do you feel that, like, what do your thoughts that can everyone heal? Like, or are there some people that are almost susceptible to being able to heal? Or can everyone, do we all have that potential?
Okay, let's define healing first. Like, what do you mean by heal? Because if you mean, is everything that a person might suffer from physically, can all of that be completely reversed and full physical health be restored? I'm not sure about that. That doesn't look likely to me. I haven't seen people regrow limbs and stuff like that, for example. I mean, I don't know, maybe that's possible, but there are certainly people for whom full physical restoration doesn't seem available to them. Let's put it that way. But does that mean they can't heal? I would say, no, it doesn't mean that. Because to me, healing is what I would call, it's a restoration of the wholeness that we are on the inside, that we already are.
Mm.
Now, and that's actually the root of the word healing. To heal, healing, the root of the word is whole, to make whole.
Mm.
And coming to wholeness essentially means coming back to your own true nature. And how do you know you've come back to your own true nature? You're at peace with yourself. Mm. Now, is that available to anybody under any circumstance? Yes, 100%.
Mm.
Regardless of whether the physical ailment gets better or doesn't, regardless of whether they even continue to live in this body, people can come to peace in the dying moments of their life.
Mm.
And that to me is healing. And the body still dies because it's part of the cycle of life for bodies to be born and to die. So to me, that doesn't contradict what I'm saying. I think people can heal right up to the moment of death and even through the process of death. That to me is part of healing. But I'm defining healing in that way. It's coming back to that experience of oneself as a spiritual being. If we're identified with this physical form, then the healing is going to be limited. Why? Because the form is limited.
Mm. Yeah. And I think I was on, in terms of healing, like I think I remember you saying on the course I went with you back in December that healing doesn't have to, it can be more rapid than we, doesn't have to take a long time if we get that insight.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. And sometimes that's true on a physical level as well. You look at people like Anita Mojani's story, which many people will know about. Dying to Be Me was the book that she wrote about it, which is a beautiful account of what the medics call spontaneous remission. But what she came to see was a deep and profound transformation. First of all, it was a spiritual transformation where she got back in touch with her own true nature. But then as a happy side effect of that, her body physically healed from a end-stage cancer process within a matter of weeks. Now, that's relatively rare that it simultaneously happens on every level. But what's not so rare and is actually quite, I would say, quite common and readily available is that people can transform their psychologically very, very quickly. And it doesn't matter how long they've been suffering. And that's been a real revelation to me to see, is that there's no correlation between how long a person has been struggling psychologically and emotionally and how long it takes them to be restored to well-being. No correlation.
That's so positive, like empowering for people to realize that as well, because I don't think that's what, you know, the mainstream or like the most common thought process would be, that, you know, if you've been suffering for years, it's going to take years of
that's what
unwinding.
I used to think.
Yeah. So how did you, so can you give some examples of that? Because it's like, it's really positive. Give something for people to
I've seen so many examples of this. And in order to understand that and to have that make sense, part of what I learned through what's known as the three principles of understanding, one of the foundational pieces of that is what we call innate well-being. And this is, it's a different way of thinking about mental health, really, which I think is more accurate than the way that we're trained to think about it. Because what it points towards is the fact that everybody has got well-being, 100% well-being on the inside at all times, that we can't actually lose it, that it's built into the fabric of life. So then the question is, well, that sounds good, Ian, but I'm feeling depressed here, or I'm feeling upset, or I'm feeling anxious. How can you say I've got well-being? Well, that's the second piece of the understanding. The second piece is that what we experience at any given moment varies according to the thought that's passing through our consciousness in that moment. So well-being is a constant, but our experience is a variable. It's a temporary variable. So when we have very little on our mind is just open and relaxed. We feel in connection with our well-being. We just, nothing bothers us. We just feel fine. And we don't give much attention to that fact. You know, we just enjoy life from that place. But when our thinking gets activated and agitated, that starts to create, it literally creates physiological response in our system. And we get feelings which alert us to the fact that we're moving away from our well-being. And what do we call those feelings? Stress, basically. Yeah. You know, we feel distressed. And it's really interesting to think of it this way, because, you know, if you tread on a sharp object, it's a good thing that hurts. Right, we don't think that there's something wrong because it hurt. We think, well, oh, that's good, that's my body telling me there's something in my shoe, I need to take my shoe off and get rid of it. Right, the fact that we get that discomfort, we see it as helpful. But when we feel distressed psychologically, emotionally, we think that there's something wrong with us. We don't actually take it that's intelligent feedback, just like the pain in the foot is intelligent feedback, but it's a different kind of feedback. What it's alerting us to is that we're using our mind in a way that's taking us away from our experience of well-being. Now, all the person has to do is to realize that. If a person realizes that, they have an insight about it, they can literally pop right out of whatever the habitual thought pattern they've been in. They just pop out of it. And what's left is the well-being that was already there. They don't have to do anything to activate or cultivate. The idea of working on your well-being is a nonsense idea. There's nothing to work on. It's already 100% intact. And this is what I've seen over and over again, is the well-being just comes back to the surface as soon as we stop distracting ourselves away from it. So I've seen people where this happened after literally decades of suffering. Like, I remember one lady was like over 30 years of being clinically depressed. And within a matter of about an hour, she was listening to a talk that I was giving. She had an insight. She didn't know that that's what happened. She just felt something shift. And then she started speaking and says, I'm not depressed. I don't know what's happened. So she couldn't find the experience of depression in that moment. It just left her because she reconnected with her well-being, which was already there. Now, I didn't know that was possible, Lisa, before I came across this understanding. I really didn't, but I've just seen it over and over and over again now.
That's amazing. And to think, like, I often think, I mean, counselling definitely has its place, without a doubt, because I guess it can give you insight into what's perhaps caused it. But can it also do the opposite and keep you stuck?
Yes. Of course. So you're exactly right. If it's helpful, if and when the counsellor holds a space within which the person can have their own insight, that's helpful. That's the best kind of counselling. They're not giving advice. They're not necessarily going into the content of what the person's struggling with. Maybe do a little bit of that, but not too much. Mostly what they're doing is a holding space where the person can have a fresh thought. They get a fresh perspective. That's what insight is. They go, oh, I know. The person suddenly sees something that they hadn't seen before and it uplifts them. And then they're good to go. And it doesn't take long, actually. It's really, really quick. But the flip side of that, which you described, is, well, how long have you been suffering? Well, when did it all start? And are there any things that seem to be contributing to it now? Now, think about this. If we understand that thought creates feeling in our system, if we spend time with someone and what they're asking us to think about is what we're suffering with, what we're struggling with, and how long we've been struggling, and all the different flavors of struggle, the more thought we add to that, the more we get to feel it.
Yeah.
Now, I just want to emphasize, it's innocent. There aren't any therapists that I know of who are deliberately facilitating having a client, you know, feel more of what they don't want to feel. Nobody's doing that deliberately. It's a misunderstanding in the field of psychology, which has been corrected now by the insights of Sydney Banks, who introduced the three principles of understanding. He saw this very clearly, and he had many dialogues with psychologists. He said to them, you know, tell me what you're doing. How does it work, psychology? And they're telling me, he was horrified. He's like, really? You go back into all those traumas? Are they not trying to forget about those things?
Yeah.
It didn't make any sense to him, because he knew that there was a simpler way that was actually more effective, which was to orient the person towards their well-being, towards the fact that they're actually okay. No matter what's happened in the past, nothing in the past has any hold on us except to the degree that we continue to think about it.
What about then? Okay, just to play devil's advocate, what about a lot of, you know, you see on Instagram or social media or trauma work? What about like subconscious trauma, or is that, you know, how does that hold on to us?
Yeah, and it's become much more in people's awareness now, which again is both good and bad. For some people that's helpful, because it helps them to join the dots and to see, you know, what they've been struggling with. They realize, oh, there's a reason, you know, and that can be helpful. If a person can see that I'm not just going crazy, like my nervous system is actually overreacting to something that it thinks is threatening. You know, that's good to know for some people. However, people can get just as stuck in a story of trauma as they can get stuck in anything else. And I've seen this many times. So most of the thought that we're experiencing is not conscious. That's the first thing to say. The amount that we're conscious of is maybe 1 or 2%. You know, when you catch sight of the fact that you're thinking something, we think that that's thought. I mean, it is, but it's the tip of the iceberg. So most thought is operating below the level of conscious awareness, and it's what you would just call unconscious patterns. But it's made of the same stuff. It's just thought that we don't know that we're thinking. Right? And it's probably a good thing that we don't. I mean, if we were aware of it all, we would be driving ourselves crazy just with that volume. You know, it would be like having the radio on full blast all the time. So it's a good thing that most of it's delegated to the background of our awareness. But the downside of that is that we're still feeling the energy of that thought, even though we don't know we're thinking it. So when someone is seemingly stuck in what we call a trauma response, that's really all that's going on. They've acquired, you see, trauma is not what happened. It's the meaning, it's the internal meaning that we make of what happened. Right? We make something of it using thought. And it's not deliberate. We don't do it consciously. It happens in an instant. So something happens when we're young. It upsets the apple cart of our life. And our mind goes, oh, this is unsafe. Or life is unsafe. Or, you know, so we draw some big generic conclusion about life based on very flimsy evidence. And then we carry that pattern forward into life. So now we're going through life with a feeling and a thought pattern that says it's unsafe. What that means now is we're filtering for experiences that confirm that. not deliberately, but unconsciously. And again, this goes back to the susceptibility. Why would we filter for something that confirms it? Because we're trying to heal it. So we gravitate towards circumstances and people and situations that are kind of poking us in that very place all the time, because that's what we're trying to heal. And it seems at the time, you know, it seems like sometimes we need to bring something into awareness in order to heal it. But what I've realized now through the principles understanding, even that is often a step too far. We don't need to make everything conscious in order to heal it. We just need to recognize the nature of it. So if we can recognize that if someone's having a trauma response now, what they're reacting to is not what happened 10 years ago. What they're reacting to is their own unconscious thought pattern in this moment. Right? That's the only thing we can actually be reacting to in real time, is something that's happening in this moment. We can't react to something that happened 10 years ago. It's not physiologically possible. There has to be something that's activating our system in this moment. It turns out there's only one thing that can do that, is thought. And people say, no, it's not. It's the external trigger. Yeah, but that lots of people walk past that trigger. They don't even notice. Right?
Yeah.
So you can't blame it on that. It's not the external. That it looks like the external. I mean, obviously there's a participatory element there going on with the environment, but really it's whenever we hear or we see or we read that thing, it's what it activates in our own thinking. It's our own thinking that we're feeling. It's not the thing itself.
Yeah, and that then applies even to, like, I guess, inherited trauma. It's just still our subconsciously there, and we're still reacting.
Exactly, because and that's why patterns run in families, and we know this. You know, there's plenty of research saying, if both your parents are depressed, it's probably more likely you're going to be depressed. And well, yeah, why is that, do you think? Because if you grow up in an atmosphere where there's a certain way of thinking about life, you're going to take some of that on, not necessarily all of it in the same way that your parents did, but some of it you're going to adopt. And so then it looks like that's genetic, right? And is it really genetic? I don't think so. It's just that that's what was modeled to us. And that's how we learn as youngsters. We look at the main influences and we adopt what makes sense to us to take on board. We're still being a bit selective. There's certain things that they try and put in us and we just reject it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can't blame it all on the conditioning, because there's lots of things that we just said, no, you can keep that one.
So true. So actually, so while we're talking of sort of inherited stuff, sort of connection to one of your other books on miasm.
Yeah.
Which I think, so I get listeners who, there are some homeopaths that listen, but also just people that are interested in homeopathy, but, you know, not necessarily have a lot of detailed knowledge. And miasms, you know, it's something, one of those words that we talk about in homeopathy. And Ian, you've written like an amazing book on miasms. So people that are interested, can you explain in your words, you know, what is, when us homeopaths start talking about miasmatic influences and things like that, what on earth we're talking about?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that homeopaths observed, and this is going back over 150 years, was that there are disease patterns that seem to go beyond the individual. And Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, was the first to recognize that. You know, he treated so many people over such a long time. He started to see that this is something that is collective rather than just belonging to the individual. And he also started to observe patterns in families. And that doesn't mean that everybody will get the same disease as the ancestors got, but there's a relationship between what the ancestors had and what the people are having now. So that was the first iteration of the miasm idea, was that there's something that's being passed on. And we're not really sure what it is. Nowadays, we talk about genetics in a similar way, right? It's like something's being passed on through the genes. This is the homeopath's way of talking about that phenomena, that there are certain things, that's tendencies that seem to get passed on. So that's one level of understanding, which in homeopathy, that was helpful because it enabled us to be able to work with people with chronic disease patterns in a way that was more curative than what we could do beforehand without that knowledge. You could actually prescribe for the tendency, not just for the presenting problem. And any practicing homeopath will recognize that's a helpful thing to know. I mean, I'm sure you've seen that many times. And we have a group of remedies that are particularly designed to work with those miasmatic energies, which it still blows my mind that we can do that, right? It's to me, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
We have remedies like tuberculinum, which is related to the disease TB. I've got ancestors. I've got at least one or two uncles who had TB as a disease. Now, I've never had TB, but I've done very well on the remedy tuberculinum. And, you know, that tendency has come through my family line, if you like. But it's an energetic thing that seems to be passed on. I don't think anyone could detect that in my genes. You know, it's something energetic, but I respond to that remedy, which to me is the confirmation that energetic influence is there. So on a practical level, it's a helpful thing. Now, what I got interested in was this area that we touched on earlier, which is, well, what if miasms have got another dimension to them as well? What if they represent growth challenges for humanity as a whole? What would that look like? And I just started to consider the miasms in that light. I wasn't altogether happy thinking about them as all they do is they create disease for humankind, which is kind of how Hahnemann presented it. You know, he talked about the miasms as this kind of scourge on humanity, that they plague us in some way. And we just got to do our best to kind of, you know, fight them with anti-miasmatic remedies. That sounded a bit unhomeopathic to me. It sounded more allopathic, like kind of get rid of the enemy, you know, the invading enemy. So I just started to think about them with a different mindset. I thought, well, what if we look at them as just neutral imprints, which are in that category that I talked about, that they're the challenges that humanity needs in order to grow and evolve. And again, I can't prove that that's what they are. But when I started to look at them in that light, they made more sense to me. And what I came to, this is the way I came to understand it, was that if we're presented with a life challenge and we meet it successfully, which means that we grow, some growth has to happen. We have to evolve in our consciousness. Then we probably don't need to develop any of the illnesses that are associated with that miasm. However, if we confronted with that challenge and we refuse the growth potential that's offered to us, like we reject it or we resist it or we try and avoid it, which we're very prone to do as human beings, then it's almost like life ups the stakes and we start to suffer, we start to get symptoms and illnesses that are in the energy of that miasm. They're within that pattern. It's almost like taking it to the next level. It's like, okay, so you're not paying attention here. Get a load of this.
Yeah.
And so then you've got to grapple with it on a physiological level. And if it gets serious enough, it's going to stop you in your tracks at a certain point. You're going to have to pay attention to this thing. So I think about, to me, looking at miasms in that way, it changes the way that you think about disease as well. I don't think about disease as something that's just gone wrong and it's a bad thing. And it's, you know, it's tough if that happens. And I'm not wishing to denigrate anybody's experience here. I'm not saying that everybody just chooses their illness or, you know, anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that there's growth potential in illness. And that's 100% true. There's always growth potential in it. And if we're willing to look at it that way, we can not only grow through it, but often we can outgrow it. And that to me is another aspect of what true healing is about, is that we actually outgrow the need to have those symptoms.
Yeah.
In the same way as we can outgrow the need to have a habit or an addiction or something like that. That's how we truly heal from those things. We don't heal them by willpower or avoiding the substance or anything like that. We truly heal them by outgrowing the need for it in the first place.
Yeah, I love that. I love that explanation. Do you think with everything, how much, I'm not sure what your view is on how many miasms there are. I know different homeopaths have different views, but with like what's been going on in the last few years, you know, do you feel like we're going to be presented with, in terms of homeopathic remedies, new miasms emerging?
Possibly. Probably not as many as some homeopaths would claim. I think whenever it starts to look really complicated and complex, we've probably gone a bit too far with our theorizing. So I still see a lot of evidence that the basic miasms that homeopaths have developed over the last couple of hundred years, to me, those are still the dominant energetic forms. But I think we are experiencing maybe new variations on those themes. Mm. And that looks likely to me. And maybe there are some that are completely new that are coming into play as well. But it does, that doesn't mean the other ones are obsolete. So, you know, we're still seeing, for example, one of the miasmatic tendencies we call the cancer miasm. And carcinosin is the associated remedy. I remember at one time in my practice, about half my patients were on carcinosin. You know, it's like, how many more people can need this remedy? It was amazing to me how prevalent that was, you know, even amongst young children. And I speak to homeopaths today, they still tell me the same thing.
So that... Yeah, my last patient was on carcinosin, and I use it. Sometimes I'm like, oh, Lisa, you know, there must...
Not again, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I recommended it to someone just the other week as well for their daughter, and, you know, and I still see that everywhere. So that hasn't gone away. And you think about, well, what's that about as a miasm? Well, one of the things that it's about is differentiating between what's truly yours and what isn't. It has to do with having clear and healthy boundaries and what we might call a clear sense of self, a clear sense of oneself in relationship to others. And that's often what people are grappling with who develop some form of cancer or another, is that there's often some uncertainty around that. And that's often the journey that they're on. The healing journey is reclaiming the sense of self, or rediscovering the sense of self in a very deep and profound way. And often, what does that involve? Well, it might involve standing up for yourself in ways that you've never had to do before. And that's not easy for someone who's always gone along with things, mm-hmm. you know, to keep the peace or something of that. So these energies, often they require us to dig deep. And I see people, sometimes they're grappling with that one theme pretty much through their whole life, just different flavors of it. But that is their life challenge, pretty much. So, yeah, there might be other things coming in, but they won't be bothered by those. They're still working on this one. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but, and I think over the... Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, there is a theme that I think has come in which is very prevalent now. And you could associate this with the whole COVID phenomena and everything around that, which I think has to do with the relationship between, I would call it individual authority, personal authority versus external authority, or internal versus external authority. I think that's a challenge that many people are up against right now. Where do you put the authority for your life? Is it inside of you, or is it outside of you?
Completely, utterly, yes. That has been highlighted hugely, hasn't it, over the last 2 years?
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of people are not aware that that's what they're grappling with, but that looks to me that that's what we are being required to grapple with right now. And it's ongoing. It's not, we're by no means over that one.
God, I think 95% of the population are in the authority comes from external.
Yeah, it's a biggie, because you can see it in so many different areas, right? There's so many different places now in life where that's showing up. It's showing up in relationship to health, and, you know, do you just go along with some vaccine program because people say it's a good idea, or do you stop and think for yourself? Do you put your child in the mainstream education and everything that involves, or are you considering, you know, the alternatives? A lot of people now are kind of looking and considering, which they've never done before, maybe because they haven't felt that there's been a necessity to do so before. But now that I think people have been shown that they've got to look in this direction in lots of different ways, we've been shown that
completely. And I think that's one thing, like, yeah, on a personal level, I'm now home educating both my kids, and I never, like, if you told me that, like, life gets more challenging, doesn't it, or whatever, I'm not going to say difficult, challenging, to help us evolve. But, you know, even when I was studying homeopathy, if someone had said I'd be homeschooling my kids, I'd be like, no way, you know. But the last 2 years pushed me, like, I cannot keep them in this mainstream situation anymore.
It's you and thousands of others.
Mm.
Yeah. It's literally thousands, if not, it's probably tens of thousands now. And many of whom say exactly what you've just said. I would never have even thought of myself as someone who would consider this. And yet here I am. I was left with no alternative. Yeah. So it's interesting.
Yeah. And I wonder how many people as well on the flip side, you know, those that perhaps for whatever reason couldn't stand up for what they wanted or went along with things because of the collective pressure are going to be needing some staphylococcus aureus or carcinosin. There's going to be more cases, aren't there?
For sure. Yeah. And it's wonderful that we have things that can help. You know, we have tools and energy healing methods that can help people along the way. I think we've got to recognize that we're all at different stages, but we're all on the same journey, essentially. Mm-hmm. And there's no value in pointing the finger or blaming people or, you know, disparaging them because they're at some stage which maybe is different to the one that we're at. We want to be reaching out to those people. Definitely. Who, if they're receptive and offering what we know is helpful and saying, look, you know, this has helped me and it's helped my family. Would you be interested? Not everybody will because they can't hear it yet, but an increasing number of people can and are doing.
Mm. Yeah, totally. Do you have, I actually wanted to ask you about remedies. Do you have a favorite remedy out of all the thousands of homeopathic remedies or, you know, any that you have an affinity to for whatever reason that you like?
Arnica.
Arnica, good old Arnica.
That's what first comes to mind. I mean, I could justify other favourites for other reasons, but Arnica is definitely still one of my top favourite remedies. And it's interesting because I read something about, I think I just had a quick look on your, when you sent me the podcast link, I look on your website and it said that what you most love to do and are passionate about is teaching home first aid prescribing. Did I read that right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, home prescribing workshops. That's where I think the power, right, the real significant change is, right?
And something in me went, yes, when I read that. I thought, oh, that's fantastic. Lisa and I are going to get on. Because when I was training a long time ago, back in the 1980s, and I was so lucky because I was in the first group that Robin Murphy taught when he first came over to the UK.
Oh, wow.
And for anybody who doesn't know who we're talking about, Robin was one of the authors. You see some of these big books here on my bookshelf. Mm. He wrote some of these big volumes that homeopaths rely upon and is a fantastic teacher. I mean, he was amazing. When he came in, he was a teacher that the like of which I just never encountered. It was like, oh my God. And in fact, that's what inspired me to get into teaching, was how I felt when I saw Robin Murphy teach. I was like, I want his job. Because it was just so inspiring it was so empowering. And he gave us permission and made it easy. I thought, I want to do that. That's just beautiful. But you know, one of the things he said, which really went in, it really struck home. He said, the highest form of homeopathy is first aid. Mm-hmm. First aid prescribing. And he said, you homeopaths, he said, you think it's all this fancy miasm stuff and chronic stuff and constitutional. He said, it's not, it's first aid. I'm going to tell you why. And he went on to explain that in his experience and also his understanding, he said, almost every chronic case that you take, if you track it back, which is what we're trained to do as homeopaths, where did it start? It started with an injury, with a shock, with a grief, with an accident, with a vaccination that went wrong, right? It started as a first aid situation.
Yeah.
And if that had been adequately treated, properly treated in the moment, someone had a home remedy kit and they knew what to do, this whole chain of health problems would never have needed to happen. And I remember him saying this. I was like, oh my God, that is true. That makes perfect sense. And
you've just, honestly, my hair is standing on end, you saying that. Like, I've got goosebumps everywhere because that is exactly what I think, you know, if actually every home had a homeopathy kit, knew how to use it, you hopefully wouldn't even need homeopaths because we'd never get to that chronic state of illness.
For the most part, yeah, we'd be redundant for the most part. There'd still be some things where we'd need the professional help. So the homeopaths don't need to worry. They'd still be they'd still have some things that they'd be called upon to help with. But yeah, if basically someone can use the first aid remedies and the acute prescribing, especially if you've got children, you have to know how to treat acutes. And by which we mean things like fevers and earaches and sore throats and, you know, the common things that come up. You can treat those things together with the bumps and the bruises and the cuts and the shocks and all of that, then most of that, what you're doing is preventative medicine. Mm-hmm. And it's huge. You never know what you've prevented, but it's loads of stuff, actually.
Do you know what? Completely. I had a client, who a little baby who raised really healthily, you know, really crunchy mom, you know, completely natural birth, you know, not vaccinated, perfect, you know, what you'd expect, and yet really bad projectile vomiting. One dose of homeopathic remedy sorted that baby right out, and it made me like, it triggered me a little bit, because actually that was the story, you know, of my daughter. She had projectile vomiting, she was put on anti-reflux medications. Then, you know, it was all suppressing right from the start. And I thought, God, if I'd seen a homeopath at that first point in time where she had that first lot of projectile vomiting, I wouldn't have had to go through, and she wouldn't have had to go through years of just layers, you know, until a vaccination tipped her over the edge. And it's like, often you won't even know what it could have prevented if you just started at the beginning.
Exactly. Yeah. So I fully endorse your direction and support you in that.
That's what I do. Sometimes I think, am I nuts for doing it? But that's what I feel called to do. I really do. So,
and it's still my favorite. One of my favorite things to do in homeopathy is to teach first aid and home prescribing. Mm-hmm. I still love to do that because it's so empowering when people start to see what they can do for themselves and their own families. You know, when someone has never had exposure to that before, and they're in this constant cycle of antibiotics and, you know, dependent on going to the doctors and not really being satisfied. You know, people have that feeling of like, this is not really doing it. I'm just going round and round in circles. And suddenly they have a different opportunity, an alternative, which they didn't know existed, which can do something which is almost like a miracle. You know, you see literal miracles of healing happen from the first aid and the acute remedies, especially. You know, I've seen someone bang their head and the bruise coming out like an egg. And I've happened to be there with I've got even better than the remedy kit. Look at this. This is on my key ring. It's like one of these little.
Oh, I love it. Like a dog tag. Like what you put there. Isn't that what dog pets have with the little rolled up piece of paper?
I actually bought this one in the US years and years ago. They use this for people with angina. They put a little dose of nitroglycerin in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if someone has this is a medical one, but it's pretty much the same as the dog tag ones. So if someone has an angina attack, they snort a bit of nitroglycerin. I think that's what they use. So I bought that. I thought, oh, this is perfect. Arnica 200 in that. Now, I must have used and replenished this 300 times. I have no idea how many times, really. And the fact that I have it with me at all times, because it's my door key right next to it, so I don't leave home with it. I don't always take my kit with me, but I always have this with me.
Yeah.
And I have seen so many people, Lisa, and it's like literally you've watched the egg appear. I've asked them if they're open to it. Often people that I didn't even know. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. I've given them Arnica 200 and it goes and disappears. Literally.
Amazing. Disappears.
I mean, I wish I had, you know, video cameras running. I was like, or it's been like an allergic reaction. The eyes closing. I saw this with my own son when he was young. He had an allergy to, I think it was egg or something like that. His eyes were closed like a boxer. His face was puffing up like this. Everybody would have said, you need to get him to the A&E immediately. We went home, homeopathic remedies, Apis 200. Within minutes, all the symptoms disappeared. I mean, literally, it was visible. You could just see it all disappearing from his face. Once you have seen that and had it be your own experience, no one can ever tell you that homeopathy doesn't work.
Oh, completely. Yeah, my experience was similar. And I just remember when I gave my daughter a remedy and just seeing it was different because it was actually for chronic case, but just seeing this outpouring of illness and rashes and like everything just coming out. And I was like, what am I witnessing? It was like some modern day miracle. You know, when you see it yourself, yeah, life's never the same again.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's the key, is that people have to experience it. I mean, some people are just open to learning homeopathy because they're open generally. They're not skeptical about it. But a lot of people, they don't know what it is. They don't understand it. They've been told a lot of negative things about it. So there's a lot of filters in the way of them coming to understand it in their mind. But if you can catch them at a susceptible moment and let them have an experience of it, people can't deny their own experience.
Yeah.
So that's the other reason Arnica is my favorite. You know, people feel the difference when they take it.
Yeah, completely. I'm conscious of time, so I want to ask you a couple more questions. That's all right. I don't want to keep going over.
I'm not in a hurry, so you decide when.
Oh no, brilliant. Okay, I give you a get out if you suddenly like asking too much. I wanted to ask actually, based on what you just said, where you feel where homeopathy's place is in the future. You know, all these attempts to discredit it, you know, if you go on Wikipedia, it's pseudoscience and quackery and at best placebo, and yet it does continue in some way. You know, it's been taken off the NHS or much harder. How do you think it's got a place in the future? And
yeah, of course it does. It's never going away, and I've never worried about those things. I've always seen it as a cyclical phenomena, that there are cycles of time. And I think if we think of it in a bigger time frame, then we won't be so concerned. Right now it's on the up again, you know. Homeopaths, all the homeopaths I know are busier now than they've been for years, and again partly through the kind of collective COVID experience, and also the fact that a lot of people can't even get to see a GP if they want to right now. So that's, you know, that's causing people to be more open to trying other things, among other reasons. But what is it that will save homeopathy from any kind of attack and attempts to discredit it is the fact that it's founded on a principle of nature. So the principle of healing via homeopathy, what we call the law of similars, it's something that's built into nature, which means it can never go away. You can never suppress that, and no one can ever own it and patent it and do anything with it. It's just built into life. It's like gravity. It's just a fact of how one of the ways that life heals itself naturally is through resonance, through similarity. And what Hahnemann did, to his brilliant genius, his credit, was that he found a way to systematize that into a system of medicine so that we could discover what anything, any substance in the world, we can discover what it's capable of helping. And so far, everything that we've tried has produced some kind of symptoms that it can help, which is just amazing. That means the whole natural world is a pharmacopoeia for homeopaths, right? Isn't that mind-boggling?
It is. Do you think that's also, it's not down, like that's what makes it hard, is how many remedies there are? Like, you know, it can be so overwhelming.
Yeah, it can. And I think we've got to be wary of that. It's a bit like the advance of technology nowadays. Just because we can doesn't mean we should. You know, we sometimes get carried away as humans. It's like, oh, you know, let's do more of this, more of this. And more isn't better. And homeopathy should teach us this. Less is more. And I still believe that we can do most of our healing work that's needed. We can do it with a very, very small number of remedies. You look at what the early homeopaths were achieving with less than 100 remedies. I rarely go outside of a group of, you know, 50, 60 Polycrest remedies, the ones that I treat as, I know as friends, you know, the ones that I really know very well. I just use the ones that I know, and I can pretty much function very well as a homeopath. And then people say to me, yeah, but Ian, what about this? I've never even heard of the remedies that they're talking to me about. And I don't feel any the worse for not knowing about it, you know?
Yeah.
So to me, I think that a lot of these things, homeopaths themselves get a little bit too carried away with new shiny things, because that's just a human tendency. And that's not to say that we don't need to keep developing the art and science. Obviously we do, but I don't think we need to have, if it starts to get to the point where it looks and feels complicated and complex and difficult, then we need to rein it in a bit, because we're losing sight of the essential simplicity of homeopathy. If you've got too many remedies in your head that you can't actually manage or handle anymore, you're not going to function so well as a practitioner. You do better to get rid of some of them from your head and just work with the ones that you know really well, because then you'll have more like clear eyes. You can see what's actually going on. If our mind gets too cluttered, we're not effective at anything.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And actually, I wanted to ask you about different methods, because obviously you wrote the Green Book, the guide to the methodologies of homeopathy, and any homeopath or homeopathic student is going to know that book very well, where you discuss all the different methodologies. I read that really late in, like towards the end of the first year, and I was like, why on earth didn't someone tell me to read this on day one? It like would have helped so much.
I don't know why, but a lot of the training schools, they kind of save it, you know. I think they believe it's like it's a bit of a corrupting influence, you know, like you've got to learn pure homeopathy first and then you can get corrupted. It's something like that. I don't know.
But it was so like enlightening when I read it. I was like, God, I wish I'd read this earlier. I would have like, it would have made life so much simpler. So what is your thoughts on like the different like methodologies? You know, you're saying homeopathy, you know, it's simpler. You know, we want things to be simple. And then there are all these different methods. You know, there's like where you can do detoxes, which I think is where I get a lot of interest out of, I guess, because it's quite allopathic and it's it seems most allopathic and people want to detox. What does that even mean, detox? But yeah, what's your thoughts on whether more the classical side or different methods? Yeah.
I was lucky to train with Robert Davidson, who was the founder of what was called the College of Homeopathy. It was the only one back in the day. It was the first and only homeopathic school, and all the other colleges since have been replicating that template that he put in place to this day. And Robert came up with a term. He was really the inspiration behind that book. And the term he coined was, he called it appropriopathy, which by which he meant we should be adapting the way that we prescribe so that it's appropriate to the needs of the individual patient. Yeah. We shouldn't have an idea, a preconceived idea as to what kind of homeopathy they need. We should let them tell us, and then we just adapt it accordingly. And Robbie Murphy said exactly the same thing. So we don't need to have our head full of, you know, like, oh my God, is this person going to need this kind of prescribing or that? Again, that just makes us confused. We just need to be open and we listen to the person and we let them tell us what they need. And then the method becomes obvious. And then within that method, the remedy becomes obvious. And then the potency becomes obvious and the repetition becomes obvious if we let the person tell us. So we're just responding to what's in front of us. So if someone has just fallen over in front of you in the street, what method do you need? First aid. You don't need to think about it. You just give the first aid remedy, right? Because you're being appropriate to the needs of the individual. Now, if someone tells you, my child was doing great and they were just thriving and everything, and then they got this vaccine or they took this drug. And I tell you, I told the doctors this, but they didn't believe me. But I'm telling you that their health went downhill since that day and they've never recovered. And parents know, mamas especially know the truth of what has actually happened. And what do we know we can do in homeopathy? This is not general detox. This is specific, appropriate prescribing because the person knows what happened. So we can use potentized remedies which are an exact match for whatever it was that they were given that effectively poisoned them, that has left them with what we call a never been well since scenario. So that's another method of, you know, we're adopting a particular methodology because they've told us they've never been well since a poisoning incident. So we're using homeopathy in that way. But to me, that's all it's about, really. It's just knowing that there are all these different ways that we can use homeopathy. We don't have to decide ahead of time and we don't have to get fixed in any one box. We just let the person tell us what they need. Most chronic cases will actually need more than one method as we go through the treatment protocol. You know, there'll be one thing that they start off with and there'll be something else that follows. And then eventually we're getting back to the more constitutional prescribing, which is more the healthier remedy pictures.
And what advice, like for people that are listening, that are looking, so that's, I guess, yeah, from the homeopath and how we prescribe. What about for people listening that are thinking, right, I want to go and see a homeopath. How do I find one? Or like, do I do one that's labels themselves as a detox specialist or a classical? You know, what advice, I guess, for people that that wants to start with homeopathy, how they should find a homeopath?
It's a good question, because I personally, I'm not happy just looking on a list, you know, on a register or a list of names, because it's just a list of names. What do I know? So for me, the best first port of call is word of mouth. If you can find it, ask the people that you know. If you know, if there's anyone in your network who's been to a homeopath and had good results, ask them, first of all, who do they recommend? And does that sound like someone that you could work with? It may or may not. So personal word of mouth recommendation. If that doesn't help or if that's not enough, then most homeopaths nowadays at least have a website. And some of them might have Facebook profile, or they might have a YouTube channel even, like yourself, or a podcast. Well, that's a good way to get to know what kind of homeopath they are. Because really what you're looking for is someone who seems to resonate with what makes sense to you. So again, we have to be susceptible to find the right homeopath. You
know? Yeah.
Not everybody's going to work for you, obviously. And that's not just true of homeopathy. So I recommend to people to trust their own instincts and their own gut feeling. Even if someone comes recommended, if you check them out and it feels a bit off to you, don't go there. Keep looking, because there'll be someone else who will look and feel like a better fit for you. And you'll know, learn to trust. That's part of how we learn to heal, is we learn to trust our own instincts. And we don't just listen to what people are telling us. That's like, it goes back to the internal authority piece again, right?
Yeah. And yet it's got to be what resonates, isn't it, right? Because I mean, I am, both me and my two daughters, we have three different homeopaths between us.
Yeah, me too. I've recommended her to different homeopaths than I might have gone to, because I had the sense it would be a good fit for her.
Yeah.
But she still went and checked it out for herself, and then she made her own decision. And that to me is the right way around. Is I'm not going to say, like, you must see this one, because I think they're good.
So. Yeah.
You're right, it's a resonance phenomena, and that is part of the healing journey, is that we're learning to listen in to our own system and to listen to our own wisdom and to follow. That's how we heal on a deep level. So why not start at the right place? you can even choose your practitioner using that same faculty, and I really recommend that people do.
Yeah, wise advice. Okay, and then I've got this question. It's just a small question which I wanted to end on, which was, if you could implant one piece of knowledge into every human on the earth, what would it be?
Just a small one, you said.
Oh my gosh, in future, I wonder if I should give this as a question before I, give time to reflect.
It would be that they're already 100% okay on the inside.
Yeah.
I would want everybody to know that, no matter what their life looks like currently, no matter what their circumstances, no matter even what they're feeling emotionally, no matter what they might be suffering with physically or in any other way, no matter what's happened to them in the past or might happen to them in the future, they're always 100% okay on the inside, in their essence. Their essential being is not touched by any of that.
How different would the world be if everyone thought that, of being transformed, wouldn't it?
That would be transformative, because it would take most of the things that we get caught and worried about off our minds. We would realize that we don't actually need to be worried about those things. All these things are just temporary comings and goings. Mm. And right behind them, we're already okay. Mm. Yeah.
Ian, thank you so much. If people want to know more about you, or I'll put links in the show notes, but where can they, how best to get in touch or find out more about you?
Yeah, they can find my website, which is theinsightspace.com. That's where I post trainings and events. And there's also a lot of free resources on there that people can have a look at. There's video recordings that I've done, audio things, and some articles and what have you. So, yeah, take a look at that. And if anybody's got any questions, they can reach out to me via the website. And you can find me on Facebook as well. I'm still on there.
Amazing. That's great. Oh, yeah, I'm surprised you weren't deleted after your quote that went viral, didn't it?
It's interesting. Yeah, I think it's kind of new. It was neutral enough that it would have been difficult to make the case that I would, because I wasn't telling anybody what they should or shouldn't do, or I wasn't, in a sense, it wasn't being overly specific. I was just making a general point with that.
Yeah.
I think the quote that you're referring to was...
Yeah, I was going to ask, yeah, do you remember? Can you share it?
I can't remember it exactly, but it was... I reposted it shortly because it was a year since, and Facebook does that
cool
thing of like, you know, this. Remember this from a year ago?
And yeah.
I do remember it because it went absolutely mad. I've never seen anything get shared so widely of the various things that I've posted. But the point I was making was that if you have to be persuaded and cajoled and lied to and given all kinds of incentives and guilt tripped and punished and criminalized, if all of that has to happen in order to have you comply with some treatment, with some medical procedure, then what that says to me is that you can be totally certain that what's been offered or promoted is not in your best interest. Mm. So much force has to be used to make you do something, it's not in your best interest. So I was just making that as a general point. I wasn't even saying what I was talking about beyond that.
No, that's probably why it managed to go viral.
I think that's how I got away with it, yes.
Because it wasn't fact-checked. It was like too vague, wasn't it? But everyone knew exactly what you were.
Right, but actually it's not just about the one obvious thing. I mean, a lot of people would have joined the dots and made the connection. But to me, it's a general principle which applies to lots of things.
Mm. Yeah, no, it is so true. But yeah, it was everywhere. So no, it's great you're still on Facebook, so people can connect with you on Facebook as well.
Yeah, for now. Maybe one day I'll get kicked off or I'll decide that I've had enough of it, but... It's still a good way to connect with people, isn't it? I mean, you reached out to me through Facebook, so I'm grateful that it affords these opportunities, even though it has downsides. Like everything, I think these things, we've got to see them as neutral.
And
it can have negative connotations if we're not careful. But if we use it with some consciousness and we use it intentionally, then it can be really a gift and it can be something that's empowering and helpful. And it can connect people who are of like mind and make things available. So why not focus on what's possible through these platforms?
Yeah, I like that way of thinking completely. Got to look at it that way, definitely.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Lisa. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Happy to chat anytime.
Oh, I've loved it. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been brilliant having you on.